Erica Tenquist, and I'm interviewing Bruce Drown, who lives in Hastings. And the date today is the 26th of November 2018. Over to you, Bruce.
Good morning, Erica. I just want to talk about the Drown family in Hawke's Bay for a start. The Drown family in Hawke's Bay was started by my grandfather, Matthew Thomas Drown, who immigrated from the village of Pillerton in St. Marian, Cornwall, about 1876, and went to Australia and then to New Zealand. His father, Richard Drown, my great-grandfather, was a blacksmith and a manufacturer of agricultural machinery, horse-drawn implements of the day. Just as a matter of interest, the royal coach used for Queen Elizabeth's coronation was renovated by the Drown Brothers of London. So that must have been part of my great-grandfather's family immigrating from Cornwall to London. Matthew Drown, Matthew Thomas he was, and was known as Tom. Matthew Drown married Eva Joel, and they had two sons, Leslie and Ronald. Each of them had three sons, and Leslie also had one daughter, my sister Glenda. I am the second son of Leslie Herbert and Marie Nee Hughes Drown, and I was born on the 3rd of November 1937. My father Les left the New Zealand Post Office and contracted with steam engine and thrashing mills before purchasing 12 and a half acres of land in Park Road South and working it as a market garden and orchard. His father Tom retired from his handily located 5.5 acre block in 1941, aged 85, and came to live with us. And he passed away in 1950 when I was 14 years old. So I grew up with my granddad, who arrived when I was 4 and passed away when I was 14. So I remember him well.
How did he adapt to New Zealand?
Very well. When he went to Australia, he worked as a manservant for a wealthy landowner. And he told me the story, one of his duties was to feed the master's dogs. And on this occasion, one of the maids inadvertently fed the dogs. And my grandfather reprimanded her, and she reported him to the master, who called him into his office and said, "Matthew, did you or did you not say this to the maid?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I did." "Well," the master said, "I must ask you to leave." And I said, "Well, sir, the sooner I leave, the better I shall be pleased." And I packed my bags and I came to New Zealand. So that's how he started. When Matthew Thomas arrived in New Zealand, he went out to the coast and worked as a cowman gardener on a big station, and then later on bought this land in Tollemache Road, Hastings, 5.5 acres, as where he reared his children, Les and Ron. He was a wonderful old man. He was very religious. He was part of the Open Brethren in Nelson Street in Hastings. And when he came to live with us, my mother took him into her care, really. She was wonderful to him. And about once a month, she would ask me to invite some of his friends to come and have dinner with us.
Did you have a telephone then or not?
We were one of the early telephones. We had the only telephone in Park Road South. We were 2 miles out of Hastings, and all the neighbours used our phone. And we got to know the neighbours for that reason. They'd come and use the phone. Granddad, in my memory, he worked at least half a day every day of his life. He'd go down and spit on his hands and pick up the hoe and work away till lunchtime, then he'd take the afternoon off, which you're quite entitled to do when you're 85.
And was he a smoker?
Never smoked. He didn't drink. He wouldn't listen to the radio. Only when the war was on, he listened to the war news. So that was quite interesting. The two sons, Leslie and Ron, my uncle Ron, lived till he was 102. He and his brother and my father were quite different in their philosophy in life. My father was a bit of a rebel. He did like a drink and he didn't mind an argument. Ron was a bank manager and finished up as the chief accountant in the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. And he had three sons and my father had three sons. The youngest son of Ron's, Alan, was taken from us in the Tangawai disaster in the early 50s.
51.
So I mentioned my Sister Glenda, who was the only daughter for some generations, with Les and Ron having three sons each, and in turn I have three sons, and my eldest son has three sons. So there have been no girls. My younger brother Trevor, who passed away recently, he has daughters, but they disappear from the Drown name after their marriage. So that's sort of the history of how the name got started in New Zealand. I started school at the Central School in Hastings when I was 5 years of age in 1942 and went through that school and then on to the Hastings High School. In those days it was co-educational and I started there in 1950 and left there at the end of 1953 having gained my school certificate. My wife Robin, whom I met as a member of the Heratonga Swimming Club, arrived from Christchurch about 1950. She was born in the 1940s, and we met and became cobbers and friends and competitors, and we married as a young couple. I was 22 and Robin was 19 years of age when I went to wire as a young stock agent. Now, we have three sons.
Were they all born up in Wairoa?
No, two were born in Wairoa, Christopher and Timothy, and Peter was born. We decided that 10 years later, we were still pretty young. We thought if we didn't have some more children, we'd be left on our own. So Peter arrived 10 years later. He lives in Wellington as a surveyor. My eldest boy, Chris, is a nursing teacher or tutor at the EIT in Hawke's Bay. And my second boy works in large company driving trucks and merchandise things. And they have no children. The second boy and my third son have no children of their own, which is a shame, but this male thing was carried on by Chris, who has these three boys. Second boy is at university in Christchurch. He's going into his fifth year next year. My eldest grandson, Finbar, they're lovely Irish names. Finbar, he is in Australia, trained to be a chef. And Seamus, in his fifth year, is doing civil engineering as a study. And my youngest grandson, Rory, is just leaving school this year.
Bruce is now going to give the talk that he gave to the Somerset Village 2 years ago, I think.
Thank you, Erica. As I grew up and going through high school, I found a great affinity with livestock. And I worked in my spare time with a very good friend, Gordon Noel Eustick, who's now deceased. And he took me under his wing and introduced me to the duties on farming. In the August holidays, I did a lambing beat on a farm out at Fern Hill and got my driver's license at that time and was called into the vocational guidance officer's room, Mr. Rockle, at high school, and said, "Bruce, you don't seem to know what you want to do in your life, but I think you should follow what your interests are, and perhaps stock and station agency might be your forte." Well, that's what I did. So in January 1954, at the tender age of 16, with my school certificate qualification, I was offered an office junior's position in the Hawke's Bay Farmers head office by the late Sir Ronald Trotter, who was then the chief accountant, with the ambition to reach the stock department and later to represent the company on the road. The mercantile firms of the day, and in 1954 there were seven of them, offered young people like myself a very thorough and formal training while they found their niche as they were moving around the various departments. In 1956 I found myself in the stock department under the late Tom Kyle and Trevor Smith, and was allowed to attend and help at the Wednesday weekly stock sales, provided my work was up to date, and it was, even if it meant going back on a Tuesday evening till 10 o'clock to make sure it was. Those weekly sojourns confirmed for me the attraction of a lifestyle involving livestock and the camaraderie of the personnel in there. And when Mr. D.H. Grieve, livestock company manager and auctioneer, called me into his office and declared, "There is an opening for a junior livestock agent in Wairoa. Are you interested?" "Yes," I replied. "The job's yours," he said. I had recently been given a £50 rise above the award for good service, taking me to £350 annually, and now a further £200 for my promotion. £550 a year and a company car, said I. I'm on my way.
That was very good for that era, wasn't it?
It was. So I arrived in Wairoa on the 3rd of November 1957, my 20th birthday, with great expectations, little knowledge and lots of enthusiasm to make my mark or not under the guidance of my immediate boss, Barney Williams, and Cyril Howard, the manager, Jack Mulhern, who took me under his wing like a son he never had, Jack Coffey, the senior and lovable raconteur, and 12 months later, an 18-year-old Lawrence Redshaw, recently deceased and principal of Ally Redshaw Livestock, an independent and successful company. And I canvassed in my second-hand early model Holden company car and called on all farmers, clients and opposition alike to make myself and my company noticed, and it paid off. I remember 3 months later when Mr. Howard, the manager, called me into his office. Bruce, he said, I don't want you to regard yourself as a junior agent. I want you to be part of our team, and that's what you should be. I thanked him for his confidence and suggested that if that was the case, surely I should be paid accordingly. Cyril shrugged his shoulders and lifted my salary to £750 a year, a £200 rise.
And this is in 1957.
Let's go, I said to myself. The Wairoa County is unique in its isolation. Five or six arterial roads south and north, Cricklewood and Rikituri, Mahia through Nuhaka, Lake Warakamaan and Ohuka. None joined the other, but needed backtracking and restarting out again. My canvassing and work averaged 2,500 miles a month, or 30,000 miles a year, and we changed cars at about 100,000, or 3 to 4 years of time. My early model Holden was repainted in two tones of my choice, unique, and the only two-tone Holden in Wairoa.
So they'd see you coming.
Yes, they noticed. The Mahi Peninsula was predominantly farmed by the Ormond family. And history tells me that an Ormond from Central Hawke's Bay in Wallingford left the Wallingford nest and established himself with a Maori princess on Mahia. And between them, they produced a large parcel of offspring, the seniors and their children, whom I met and dealt with in my time in Wairoa. There was Dan, Joe, George, Gordon, Willie and Guy, each farming independently, some better than others. Mahia today has modernised. There is a good golf course and hotel with accommodation, sections and beach houses in demand. So 5 years later, 1962, on promotion back to Hastings, I left Wairoa with my wife Robin and two young boys, Chris and Tim, who are now 57 and 56 years respectively. No longer a novice, but a member of the stock agents fraternity. Wairoa was a founding group for me and the friends I made from my work and social life, including rugby and cricket, and kept me in good stead. Stock and agent agencies, their background is one of service to their clients. HBF Co-op in my early days was a truly cooperative company. £5 worth of shares gave the smallest shareholder the same privileges as the one with £5,000 holding. Relinquished shares could only be sold back to the company. Services provided included stock, seed and grain, motor, grocery, china and footwear, etc. Finance, clients could deposit to interest-bearing accounts with the company, which funds were then on loan to other clients who needed seasonal finance. Stock reps. As a stock rep in a given area, my job with approximately 100 clients was to know their farming policy and to assist with marketing stock to best advantage and to assist with replacement stock, including rams and bull requirements. The advantage I found of calling on all farmers and knowing their farming practice I would often marry up stock available within the area as a private sale one to another. Good stock agents were often included in family activities, weddings and birthdays, 21st birthdays, etc. In 1966, I replaced Mr. Wills Van Ash as Murray Roberts' senior auctioneer, and I sold at Storff Lodge, Waipukarau, Dannyburg, and managed the Waipukarau branch in 1969 until we merged with Wright Stevens in 1972.
How did you learn to be an auctioneer?
That's a good question. I'll tell you how it happened. It was a sudden thing that happened. My boss, Barney Williams, one day at the seller's pen boy. Well, I sold the pen. I didn't see any bids. The tears was rolling down my cheeks. Anyway, that was a start, and I did a little selling after that. And I said to my boss, Barney, one day, how am I getting on, Mr. Williams, as an auctioneer? He said, you'll never be an auctioneer as long as your ass is pointing towards the ground, boy. Well, that was a challenge. So I practiced. I took bids off the lampposts as I went past, as I drove around the countryside. And that's how I got started and went on from there. And I became quite good. So that was getting started in auctioneering, as I've said, all the areas I sold in over the next few years. When we merged with Wright Stevens in 1972, I joined Kelvin Tremaine and Ralph Greencree as a real estate Hastings partner. I was qualified by examination, and later I went back to the Hawke's Bay Farmers again until my appointment as Federated Farmers Hawke's Bay Provincial Secretary in 1981, which went on until 1987. Now I'll talk a bit about Federated Farmers. My brief with the, we'll call them the Feds, was to encourage other rurally based industries under our watch, and we successfully became secretaries to the Hawke's Bay Vegetable Growers and the Hawke's Bay Asparagus Growers, the New Zealand Sheepdog Trial Association, and ran a cadet scheme of 32 young cadets on different first to 5 year duration and placed them on farms. At farmers' request, I represented them on the Hastings District Chamber of Commerce and chaired the District Affairs Committee. I represented Federated Farmers on a high-powered regional committee comprising the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries, Bill Crawford and Noel Condon, politicians, Sir Richard Harrison, meat companies, Gordon Ansford, and the Rural Bank, Brian Nielsen. The Federated Farmers and this group made submissions to government and hosted unions and politicians and remained apolitical, totally apolitical. Yes. That period in the 80s was dramatically poised for farming. Roger Douglas and David Lange's government, rearranged the New Zealand economy and farming future as standalone and non-subsidised. Federated Farmers, while supporting the direction of their policy, criticised its only partway policy. It never went right to the end. As land values halved and the interest rates doubled, combined with low commodity prices, many farms became uneconomic. For example, $500,000 farm costing $500,000 with $250,000 mortgage at 7.5% became valued at only $250,000 with an interest rate of 15%. So they were mortgaging the whole of their farm at a high rate, and it was untenable. Lots of reconstruction took place, with all parties combining to assist. After resigning from Federated Farmers in 1988, I acted as a field officer for a local horticultural export company, including squash to Japan, venison to the United Kingdom, and stone fruit to Australia, at the same time retaining the New Zealand secretaryship of the New Zealand Sheepdog Trial Association until 2007, and being appointed as the New Zealand secretary to the South Devon Cattle Society for a period, until they changed their venue of operation in 1996 to Fielding. At about that time, I commenced on my own account in winter grazing regime of lambs in orchards and vineyards.
You didn't own them, you just
grazed them.
Grazed your sheep on those farms.
Right, and I sometimes had to pay a grazing rate, most times.
In the Wairarapa at that stage, that was quite beneficial for all the farmers to have enough grazing land on their own places.
Exactly right. There was a period of time when you couldn't graze orchards because of the spraying, DDT sprays and those sort of things. In fact, where we're living here now, we're not supposed to plant anything in the ground that you can eat because of the arrangement with the spraying years ago.
And yet they're still spraying over the fence.
Exactly. I had two government appointments, one as a drought coordinator for Hawke's Bay, and one with Federated Farmers, the other as an individual in the late 1990s. I was also contracted as a commission agent and auctioneer to Central Hawke's Bay stock buyers from 2003 to 2006, and I was appointed as a livestock procurement manager to Napier-based Fresh Meats in New Zealand Limited. These mixed but closely related activities kept me in touch with the personnel within the stock world, which I loved then and still do. Now, looking out of lounge and kitchen windows, we have an unrestricted view of the Tamata Peak, which I leased from the board for 6 years for an income near to nil, but a deal of personal pleasure to wander those hills with an interest in their future.
So what do you think about the track?
I think the track, it was a wonderful idea. I think if people had been involved early in talking to the Maori people, told about it, I don't think there would have been any trouble at all. However, let's see what happened. I'm going back to auctioneering, Erica, if I can. Can I talk about that?
Yes.
You asked me how I got started earlier on. The art of auctioneering is fascinating and has a number of requirements. Firstly, with livestock, a sense of values, so important, and then you have to be confident, which improves with experience. A voice that's not necessarily loud, but pleasant to listen to and gain the buyer's attention. A touch of humour when it's appropriate, and the gaining of your vendor's support, and a bit of homework on the phone to let people know what stock's coming in before it actually arrives. The sale yards is the life of the industry. A typical day is as follows. Up at 4 to 4.30 in the morning, to be at the sale yards by 5 to 6am, arrival at the yards, agents putting boots on, complete silence except the cattle being driven from the holding paddocks. Then the trucks of sheep and cattle, the drafting yards, penning up, the laughter, sometimes arguments. Cooperation between all the companies to pen the stock up, morning tea or breakfast, the auction start, vendors discussing results with each other, buyers taking delivery from the agents, trucks reloading, and drovers to the holding paddocks for the stock. I must tell a story about Alex Shewan, who was one of nature's gentlemen, but known as a hard case. Lovely person, became a friend of mine, and he told a story at one of our parties at the sale yards, and it went something like this. There I was, in my inimitable manner, seeking a payload at the U Fair. Finally, I got a payload to take to Tutera. So off I went. As I was going through Napier, I called in to see my old friend, whose name is Russell Pettigrew. He got the whiskey bottle out and we had a couple of drinks. He said, Alec, get on to Tutera, get rid of the sheep, come on back down, call in again, we'll finish the bottle. Well, what an incentive. Off I went, got to the property, unloaded the sheep, back down to Napier I went, pulled into the yard. As I got out of the truck, I heard, bah! And I hadn't unloaded the bloody cab pen. There were still 12 sheep on the truck. And I had to go all the way to Tara to deliver them. So that was Alec. So we're going back to the sale, yes. Then we went back after the sale to the office. We had to write up the sale. Clients of the day coming in sometimes to have a beer or a talk or a whiskey. She had then back home for tea and canvassing on the telephone. We had a lot of drovers in those days, Erica. These men with their horses and dogs were an integral part of stock movement through the 1960s. The county was interspersed with holding paddocks and drovers' huts at intervals of a day's drive, say 10 miles. Initially, they would ride out to the job for a day's pay, but latterly were taken by local transport to start the drive and were picked up by junior agents in the evening and returned before daylight the following day to proceed for another stage. Companies had holding paddocks handed to the sale yards, where they were fed hay overnight and driven to the sale in the morning. Mobs may have been mixed together. Stock had individual farmers' earmarks and were drafted by agents to separate them. Drovers, I remember, had all gone now, and their names were Donald Struthers, Harry Royal, Mason Harries, Alec Walker, Arthur Pritchard, Bill Taylor, Joe Green, and Spencer Dillon, who actually drew a ballot in a land and survey ballot later on. Bill Taylor, the drover, was a horse whisperer. On one occasion, perhaps more than one, he purchased horses at a horse fair, changed their appearance by grooming, platting, cutting, and reselling at the same sale for a profit. Arthur Pritchard was a dear old boy that I knew well. He was sitting in the water table with the stock going backwards and forwards, and when the local stock agent who told me the story pulled up and said, "What's happening here, Mr. Pritchard?" And as he was sitting there, this dog ran past and Arthur pinged him with a stone. As he went back the other way, he pinged him again with a pebble. And the stock agent said, "Why are you annoying that dog, Mr. Pritchard? Why are you pestering him with pebbles?" "Well," he said, "he's annoying me, so I'm annoying him." There was Harry Royal, always with a waistcoat, a lovely hat, a pocket watch, and a lovely old gentleman. The railways were most important in those days. They were protected by legislation in those early years from road transport, and they were restricted to running 50 miles against the rail. That's the road transport. That meant, for example, that stock destined for Stawford Lodge sale from Wire on trucks could go to Waikari, have to be loaded onto another truck coming up from Hastings to go to the destination. What a nonsense. Absolute nonsense. The railway always had an intermittent destination requiring another option, say a truck or a drover, to complete the trip.
So you mean that they could be driven part of the way and then trucked the rest of the way, or they could be changed from one truck to another?
Because of the 50-mile limit transport, you couldn't put stock on a truck in Warren and take them to the Stawford Lodge sale. They had to go on
in
a
two
truck
stages.
But if they went by rail, they'd go to just south of Hastings, and it still had to be picked up by a truck or a drover to get them back to the sale, when they could have gone straight from the farm in Wairoa to the sale in Stawford Lodge. That happened eventually. Now, that's what happened in those days. For instance, in my early years in Wairoa, during a long period of drought, we, the company, had 1,200 cattle sold on the Mahé Peninsula in drought conditions, but the railways couldn't supply
the railway stock.
No, they couldn't supply them for 10 days. And I said to them, I was only young, and I said, "Listen, I'm going to send transport up there. You can do what you like about it if you can't supply the trucks." And I did that, and they didn't prosecute. Good sense prevailed. But road transport, when sense had prevailed regarding mileage restrictions, 50 miles against railway, a major transformation over time took place. No more meeting deadlines for trains, they were generally late anyway, and waiting for wagons to be placed for unloading at 2:30 in the morning. We had 60,000 ewes at one sale in the Waipuka, I remember, in the late 1990s, carted in and out to new surroundings and farms, all by road transport. They ran a very efficient organisation, and they held their prices well. Sheaving cattle to two major freezing works on a 5 to 6 day basis. Lambs were drafted at daylight in those days until 11 a.m, then trapped and killed on the same day as the freezing
which
works.
Which is what it should be.
Yes, quite right. Major companies included the following: Roy Sherwood, David Walker, Cyril Wilkie, Jay Sherwin and Son, and Alec was the man I told you about, Atwood and Reed, Knuckles Transport, Clive Cassidy, Pat Foley, Powder's Transport, Bridgman's, Murray Tor, Bambury Brothers, Stevenson's Transport, the Hall Brothers of Wairoa, Roy Dooley, and Bill Reeves and Pettigrew's. Most have been swallowed up with mergers and takeovers, leaving large fleets doing a great job. The coordinators of the firms were the secret of their success, and the person who most impressed me in Hastings in those days, the late Mr. Keith Starrick, who represented Sherwood's Transport for many years. Now, local trade butchers, Erica.
Yes.
Most of you will remember your local butcher. There were lots of them. We, the livestock people, provided the raw product at the weekly fat stock sales. they personally, or their agents, including us operating on their behalf. Do you remember Watson and Lang, the Dawn Meat Company, Leach and Jones, Wall Brothers, J.B. Fletcher, K.N. Porter, L.J. Lloyd, T.J. Thompson, Hawke's Bay Cooperative Butcheries, that was Sir Lou Harris's baby, Downey's Butcheries in Rowrica and Napier City, Artie Allen, Colin Bartlett, and many others. All of their product was processed at the Napier City Abattoir and later at the Nimona Works. Now the butcher shops with sawdust floors and huge chipping blocks and rooftop fans are no longer there. Do you remember the butcher who cut your meat to your requirements and gave the savoir to your son or your granddaughter? Mm-hmm. They're mostly gone and been replaced by prepackaged supermarket product.
I still buy my meat, most of it, from Downey's and McCarty Street in Napier.
Well, I procured stock from Bill Downey for many years. He's a top butcher.
His meat is always great.
His son would be there.
Yes, his son's there now.
Yeah, that's right. Stock and stage names, Erica. In the late 1950s, there were 7 mercantile companies who were in various stages established in Hawke's Bay, each in competition with each other, each with a staff dedicated to servicing their clients, and all of them believed they were the best company. They were essentially correct in that belief and were encouraged by the employers to be so. They all operated with a sense of team spirit. The 2 cooperatives within them, that was W&K and Hawke's Bay Farmers, had a little different philosophy from the national companies in that their equation provided a dividend could be struck and rebates paid and staff awarded a bonus, their aim was to annually set aside some funds and to provide a service. The co-ops kept the others honest in a truly competitive sense, covering all the farming inputs needs and catering for the marketing of pastoral production while providing appropriate advice on the selling and buying options. That sort of concept created a pretty tidy working environment and an industry surrounded by a periphery of servicing arms, all doing well and on spending into towns like Hastings, Napier, Wairoa, Wapakarau, Dannyburg and Gisborne. So that's it. The following resume of a career of rural orientation is mostly one of satisfaction. It is interspersed with some disappointments, mainly because of others' decisions, sometimes my own, but I wouldn't want to change much. My life membership of the New Zealand Sheepdog Trial Association, a rarity for a non-dog trialist, and the Havelock North Squash Records Club in its formative years are 2 life memberships that I'm proud of.
And so you deserve to be too.
Thank you. And Robin, my wife, has shared and supported me over 57 years of our marriage, and I thank her for that. In summary, I have enjoyed the chance to pen some thoughts. Doing so has brought back to me memories forgotten, but dear to me, particularly those icons of the industry whom I and others in my era remember for various reasons. The men who went before me and had different talents and are remembered with respect. I would like to think some areas of my contribution are ongoing in the memories of others. I would like to share my love of working dogs and family with you.
Thank you. Bruce is going to tell us a story about his particular pet.
Thank you, Eric. I explained to you when you asked me whether I'd been a dog trialist that I had working dogs, and I had one in particular that I loved. With my wife, we were living at Maraca in a small lifestyle block, and I went to feed this dog. His name was Nick, and he ran onto the road, and he was killed on the road. And we had been planning to go into town for a meal, and I said to Robin, I'll just look after Nick. Let's go to town and have that meal. So we went, and I had a few drinks, Erica, and I was worried about things. I got home, and I sat in my office, and I wrote a poem, and here it is. It's just a narrative poem. Come down, said Trev, the bitches whelped, and pick a pup. Sire unknown, we think they're Ben's, Ron Phillips' dog, by Dan. And if they are, they'll work real well. But if they're not, well, what the hell. So down I went, and I'm no judge, but I do have a feel for stock. And using that, good bone, strong head, he wasn't that big, but he was black, as the ace of spades. And I named him Nick. Nick was one of two that were kept that day, and when weaning came about, I took him home, and Robin took over his rearing. A mind of his own but willing, and an outlook that was bold. He thought Rob's chickens were for killing, no matter what he was told. Too tough, as he grew for our little place, his potential would never be reached. It was clear what he wanted was to give him some space. So to Carew with Bullard, Anne's husband, he went, not in disgrace, but for experience and discipline, unknown barriers to be reached. And back to the trust road he came, when the shearing muster was done. He was grown by then, still a baby by age, but maturing, said Bullard. Day by day, I'd love to keep him, he's a good one. Now, if you have had children, loved them as we have, all three, and gone through the stages of growing with them and wondering as to what they'll eventually be, and you have hopes and ambitions on their behalf, well, they wander through youth with a grin, and they discount your worries and concerns with a laugh, as though worry and concerns were sin. Well, Nig was like that. He was a kid with a talent. He thought when you growled, you were mad. And he'd cock his head to one side, lolling tongue and mouth wide, as if saying, they yarded, it can't be that bad. But I wanted more for him and from him. And Murray Cranswick, my mate from the feds, took him home to his hill country property to instill some strong sense into his head. And Murray soon found, as I had explained, that Nig was no ordinary dog, but a personality all of his own, with strengths that were natural to stock. And as time went by, when Murray and I, in the course of our farming endeavours, were perhaps on the phone, and I'd say, how's Nig going? He'd say, great, really well. And one night that became, would you sell? Now I had to be fair to them both, to Murray, who trained him, and to me, who adored him, that to lose him forever was loath. So we struck up a deal, $200 for his hill country life, till it became just too hard for him, at which time he would come back to flat land and home, to retire and to keep in his hand with no strife. And come home he did, earlier than arranged. It was the highlight of my year. Murray rang to confirm that our deal was still on. He had had a change of career. It was an opportune time. I was back in the game of selling livestock for a firm. And with Nig in the team, no task, it would seem, was a problem now that he was in charge. For 5 years we teamed up in harness. Hard work. But fun as we went, mustering hill country, orchards, Mariah Kakao lifestyle and sale yards, there was no idle time to be spent. He was the best, so said the rest of the agents and farmers who saw him. A dog who could head without noise as he did, and who hunted with punch in the din. I knew he was good, far better than me when it came to completing a task. Once he knew what was wanted, he was away in a flash, and was working before I could ask. But just as we take for granted our loved ones, our wives, children, family and friends, and think that they'll always be there, with a dog like Nig, it's the same. To not have theirs or his company to share is unthinkable. Not possible. A thing not to enter your head. But one night at dusk, at feed time, onto the highway he strayed. And with screeching brakes and a bang, he was dead. Nig is buried at home. Only I know exactly where. I grieved him. I still do. And I want any who read this to share. That a lesson in life, one to carry out, is to make sure they know, those loved ones, wives, children, families and friends, of whom Nig was a part, that you love them, respect them and enjoy them. Well, that's still there.
That's absolutely lovely. Thank you. Yeah. So how old was Nig?
Well, it was 8 when he died, I think. 1984 to 1985, so he was 9.
Pretty good life, though.
Oh, great dog. It's great. Yeah. It's a lovely dog.
But it is quite amazing, isn't it, don't you think, Bruce, that you find a dog or a cat, but mostly a dog, or a horse that just react with you and knows what you mean and what you say sure. and everything.
We have a little dog in the bedroom. I put her in there because I didn't want her to annoy you. Yep. And she's wrote, I bought it for Robin for our 50th wedding anniversary. So she's coming up 10. She's such a delight. Robin takes two walks a day. I go when I can. About 3:30, she'll be sitting over there and she'll come up to Robin. It's about time. It's got funny. She takes her away.
In the meantime, when you had been working with all these different farming and animal activities, Robin had been working for a TAB agency. Was that in Hastings?
Yep.
For 15 years.
She worked for the bank too. Well, she worked for the bank, and then she worked for the TAB. And then when she was offered the agency in Clive, she said, would you come as my partner? So I gave up.
Doing any farming?
For 5 years.
That was a complete change.
It was an absolute complete change. And it's lovely stories to be told there too.
We'll leave that for another day.
Yeah, we will.
So we're going to sign off on that note. That was the end of your working life, per se. So thank you, Bruce.